this is Katrina, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Welcome to Zooming in the Lens podcast. This is Katrina. Listen to this.
This is Kara.
Oh, hi, Kara.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you out there?
You just snuck up on me there.
Sorry.
No, it's good. I need a little surprise in my nervous system today. What is a satsang? So, a satsang is the background of everything that is happening here. A constant reminder of your Buddha nature, the very essence of who you are. I think Ram Dass said that, but I'm not absolutely sure because it's one of those memes that I dug as a way to explain what the conception of Zooming in the Lens podcast is. It's to bring people together that are happy to be in the don't know mind, that are happy to be and stay in the beginner's mind, and use that phrase of those who know don't tell. So we obviously don't know. And that's a great place to be. It sort of redirects from everything that we may have learned as kids. We were always taught to know everything or to know as much as you can or the more you know, the better. But I have been taught that the wisdom comes from knowledge that's experienced. I mean, just in that phrase alone, it feels like, all right, so maybe life is just about experiencing. Maybe it's not about gathering up all this information. I mean, me personally, I can't tell you how much knowledge is written down in these files. In a file that somebody had created for me that's now digitized. But what I think my pattern is that I learn something, or I think I'm learning something, and then I go out to learn more. I think it's a pattern we all kind of get stuck in, because in school, we weren't really learning, we were memorizing. I mean, at least I feel that way. I was memorizing, and I don't think that we were ever taught wisdom. You know, what the wisdom is I was actually having this conversation with my mom yesterday about one of the teachers that I remember from elementary school. And the reason why I remember him, Mr. Horwitz was his name, was because one day he said, you know, I can't sit in here and teach you about clouds and the sky on a chalkboard. Everybody get up. And he took us outside, and the whole class laid down on the grass and looked up at the sky, and he taught us the names of clouds. Cirrus, cumulus. Why do I remember that? Because he created an experience for me. So right there, I personally have felt that. Did that stay with me? Well, the story stayed with me, but did the understanding that whatever I learn needs to also be experienced and experienced and experienced and experienced, and then through that questioning, that very questioning of the knowledge that asks us, at least in spiritual practice lineages that I'm attracted to question knowledge, question our thoughts, question our beliefs. If they are true and they stand up for you and what you represent, and I use the word true very lightly, then they'll still be there after the questioning. But I think, I don't know how lucky you were, Kara, but I wasn't very lucky in school when I would question a belief, when I would learn about Thanksgiving, which is approaching, when I learned about the slant that I was taught about the Indians and what we're giving thanks for. I mean, not to get all, you know, political or anything like that, but it wasn't on the agenda to really understand what went on in this country at that time. So I was not questioning.
We no one taught you that we killed the Indians and stole their land and then had a big turkey dinner to celebrate?
No, you know, it escapes me now what I actually learned about Thanksgiving.
Me too.
I don't really know, but I do know that when I was recording my first record up at Longview Farm Studios in Massachusetts, and I met an Indian chief. His name was Big Bear. And when he taught me what really went on, I was shocked. And I don't feel like I should be shocked in the American educational system by a 78-year-old Native American Indian. I shouldn't have been shocked, but yeah, I was. I was shocked. I continually am shocked every day. I think being shocked every day is probably a great practice.
Okay. Teachers are put in front of us as children to look up to them without question. You didn't question your teachers in your world because they were the big people telling you things that you were in school to learn, and it's like blind faith. You go in there, they tell you this is so, and you walk away with this is so. And why people don't retain it or it doesn't become wisdom is because you're not studying it because you want to, because you have an interest in it. You're a kid who's told you have to go to school, you have to learn, you have to take the information and spit it back out on a test and do well on it so you can get on to the next thing that someone's going to tell you is a fact. And they're just shoving a bunch of things down your throat, and you're told to show up, take it in, and spit it back out. I mean, that's really what we're taught as kids. That teacher was great to do that for you, because of course that stayed with you. It's like, I remember nature walks.
Was that something you did in school?
Yeah, when we would go on a science, out on a science class on a nature walk, it was so exciting to be outside and smell the air and teach about the plants when you were looking at the plants and not in, you know, a piece of paper in a book with a drawing. It becomes real life. You know, you're smelling, touching, involving all your senses. It becomes, like you said, it's an experience then. It's not somebody just talking at you with some information that you are supposed to then, retain, believe, and offer back up at a later date.
Right. Yeah, you would think with all of this information we have now that the education system would relook at how we're learning. And of course, there's charter schools and things like that that are really creative. I mean, even a school I went to once I got into the 10th grade was an alternative school called Quest, and it really saved me. It really, really saved me. We were allowed to call our teachers by their first name. If we were late or missed school, they would call us. So it was more like college.
Right? You reminded me of? You reminded me of SWAS. Do you remember SWAS?
Yes. Yes, SWAS is, and from what I know, from what I think SWAS was how it started, and then it moved to be Quest, and Quest had to then take some orders from the Central School District, where I don't think SWAS did, but don't quote me on that. But yeah, SWAS, so these are, if you're not from New York, they're alternative ways to learn. A lot of people think that they're for people that can't learn in mainstream, and you would be right. You would be right. I couldn't learn in mainstream, but I do know that I had to take a test and that I had to have a certain GPA in order to do it. I couldn't just be a 60 average person and be, get into Quest. So I don't think it was for people that maybe had learning challenges from their mind, from their, from like an illness. I think that they were looking for people that weren't in the box, and I definitely wasn't in the box. I couldn't understand why I was learning something without being able to question it. And in Quest, you could question it. You just talk. You didn't even have to raise your hand. You would think that that would teach a child less discipline, but I learned discipline in Quest. So
that's great.
Yeah, it was a pretty great experience for me, and remembering Mr. Horowitz and learning the clouds. And if you look back in your life now, even people listening to this, what parts of school do you remember? It's probably going to be the stuff that you experienced rather than just the stuff that you learned. So, you know, to go back to the satsang definition, I think when we all come together, there's an element of that experience-based practice rather than just sitting around and learning a bunch of knowledge. That a satsang is like permission. It's like Quest. It's like, I'm not going to raise my hand. I'm just going to say what it is. And as long as you understand that a satsang isn't a place of perfection. It isn't a place we all turn up being perfect and bragging about what we know. It's actually the opposite. It's showing up in the beginner's mind. So it's already out that everybody is not about trying to gain more knowledge. We are looking for support in whatever studies that we're doing. And I really value the podcasts for that reason, because I'm allowed to practice by getting experience. And what I mean by practice is there are spiritual teachings that are out there that I had lots of questions about when I first started, and continually. And I feel like if you don't have access to a teacher one-on-one or online, that you're left in the same sort of system as we are in an educational system, where we end up taking memes off Facebook and taking these quotes, and something in us resonates with it, but who can we discuss this sort of stuff with? How can we learn how to interpret? How do we learn how to not be so linear about our thinking? How do we understand that one teaching is saying to quiet the mind and another isn't? People are getting, you know, aligning themselves with making statements like, I'm Buddhist, or I'm Hindu, or Jnana Yoga. And I don't know if, I mean, obviously not everybody, of course, but when I was saying those things, I didn't really know what I was saying. I just knew that I was aligning more with the thinking that went towards seeing things as they truly are. And if I was unable to see things as they truly are, to understand that the human life is what the true curriculum is. So it's the experience of school, elementary, high school, college. That's what can give you the wisdom and your learning skills that are allowing you to move through daily life. But if we lose that there's this curriculum alone in human life, then whatever we learn, we're constantly expecting results from. You remember that statistic we read with Lexi in the last podcast about how many people major in something in college and very few of them actually end up doing that major as a career. Now, in my line of thinking, that's fantastic. It is what it is. And maybe if you didn't do what you did in college, you wouldn't have gotten to where this other career led you, because you didn't have the experience of knowing you didn't want to do what you majored in. So I say taking action is what college is. It's just the act of taking action, because if you just sit there, it's pretty guaranteed nothing's going to happen. The internet is not the new experience. The internet is just a way to find new experiences, but we still have to go out there and experience it. And I find the internet really helpful for things like this, the podcast, being able to sit here and practice, having conversations with you, Kara, which is my satsang right now, and being willing to make mistakes. I mean, how many times were we taught not to make mistakes? I mean, that's all I was taught as a kid.
Yeah, somewhere along the line you hear then, oh, you learn, you gotta learn from your mistakes, but not when you're younger. It's funny how the teachings kind of change.
Yeah, and maybe they don't need to change. Maybe that is something we could teach younger kids. But, you know, when the kids say why, I don't know how armed we are to be able to reply to why. Because if the people teaching that person, that child, you learn from your mistakes, has actually not learned from their mistakes, you can't really teach that. It's a being rather than a doing. That's why so much of these teachings, so much of practice is unspeakable. There's not really a lot of language options in which to translate old scripture, and so then you work on interpretation. Like, how do you interpret that? How do you take that? How does that serve you? If we don't have a landscape in which to do that, I find that we just live the rest of our life with this belief of knowledge that doesn't serve us to move into experience. And I was reading this other quote that made me think of that. It's actually two, if you just bear with me, I'll be quick, I promise. Rumi, the poet, try not to resist the changes that come your way. Instead, let life live through you. And do not worry that your life is turning upside down. How do you know that the side you are used to is better than the one to come? That's of the don't know mind, right, Kara?
Yeah, because upside down is just an opinion. Maybe upside down is right side up.
That's right. And just that thought is profound. Just take that quote, put it on a sticky or on a piece of paper and hang it up somewhere in your house and read it a new way every day. You don't just read the quote and go, yeah, I get it. Okay, see you later, Rumi. I got your point. These are studies. Poetry is a study. Quotes are a study. The memes that are getting tossed around, they're a study. You can work with something like that for months, maybe years. How many different ways can you translate that? Because we don't know what Rumi meant. I mean, I don't know any Rumi scholars offhand, so I can't ask them what he originally meant, so I work with what I have. There's lots of ways to translate that, but yeah, the obvious way is we don't know what...
Does the poem have a name?
It probably does, but you know what? I don't have it.
So if we want to find it, how do we find it?
Facebook.com/functionalyoga.
You're going to post it?
I'm going to post it, and I'm also going to put it on the blog on functionalyogaonline.com. Okay. Yep, I'll put it up there. And use it. To me, this feels like, you know what, Katrina? You're wrong. And I am happy when I'm wrong. Because I'm aligning more with my heart. When I can be vulnerable enough to be wrong, I'm aligning more with my heart. My mind will always tell me that I need to be right. And it does not, excuse me, it does not like to be wrong.
Oh, no. Mine doesn't either.
Yeah, so I guess getting comfortable with being wrong is a good theme. A good theme. Yeah. Have you heard the Socrates quote? I've read it before, but it was really early on in the podcast. So you and I have been talking about suffering lately. Socrates says, if you don't get what you want, you suffer. If you get what you don't want, you suffer. Even when you get exactly what you want, you still suffer because you can't hold on to it forever. Your mind is your predicament. It wants to be free of change, free of pain, free of the obligations of life and death. But change is law, and no amount of pretending will alter that reality. That's coming from somebody from 469 to 399 BCE, so it's 5th century. So profound.
That's a long time ago.
A really long time ago. Yeah, and I mean, in that one statement, he's basically saying the first noble truth of the Buddha: all life is suffering. And the Buddha doesn't mean life is suffering because life sucks. It's the second noble truth. It's the clinging that causes us to suffering. So it's attachment that causes us to suffer. It's not saying practice unattachment, because people take that and then they just separate themselves. Okay, that's it. I'm going on a diet. No more this. And I think it's revolutionary to look at New Year's resolutions and the goals we want in life. Excuse me. From a perspective of that noble truth. How do I both be with what is and have goals? I think unattachment. Non-attachment, excuse me. Non-attachment. Now, how do you practice non-attachment? Well, for me, I don't practice it by, you know, hoping the world will rid itself of salted caramel ice cream. And yes, it might be a good skillful action that I don't stock my freezer with salted caramel ice cream if that is one of my goals. But the world has and will have ice cream, probably for the remainder of my lifetime. So to me, when looking at something like that, not that I've succeeded in this yet, I've got my shit, like everybody else. The practice of non-attachment is to look into the fire. Look into the belief systems that I've created and who in me is feeling full when I'm desiring that ice cream. Now, not from a therapeutic model so much, because we go beyond the mind, you know, to try to rest in the heart with all of this. But in the practice of non-attachment, I also have to treat myself kindly through the goal. And when you make goals, I think everything gets tossed up as a B and C plan, and we're really cruel to ourselves. So when I have salted caramel ice cream, I'm going to be a dick to myself because I have failed. Just like when you go to college for something and you don't end up doing it, you feel like it was a waste, but it was not a waste. There's nothing that's a waste. So, you know, with the ice cream example, I'm looking at the craving that I have for ice cream, and what I do is I try to see what the craving really is about, and I try not to be so linear with it that it's just the ice cream. I just love ice cream. Can't get past that place. And I also try to align myself with the skillful action of it, which is, yeah, it's probably best I don't keep it in my freezer. But the non-attachment, it also applies for when we are human, in our humanness, and you have the ice cream anyway. Because if we ridicule ourselves, believing that the ridicule is what's going to power us up to then do it for real the next time, I think that's the stuff that keeps us in that hamster wheel, that cycle of never being good enough. If the only thing you learn out of a practice of non-attachment from that angle is how to be kinder to yourself through making these goals, that would be enough. And that might be all there is for your incarnation this time around. Might be all there is for me. I mean, we don't know anything, right? So if we don't know anything, then I don't know what the right thing to do is. So I can only do it through the experience of making that goal. There's the ice cream. My desire is to not eat it. Then you eat it. And then what? Do you rip a new ass out of yourself, like for and be horrible to yourself? Or do you find forgiveness and you practice that? Either way, it's the experience that you're going for. The experience of practicing non-attachment. The experience of looking at the ice cream as and interpreting it in another way. And maybe I'm not being clear enough, but it's a work in progress. What do you have to say about suffering, Kara? I know that you've had a lot of recent sufferings. I would love for you to share that with us.
What do I have to say about suffering?
Did I put you on the spot?
No. I mean, obviously it takes all different forms. Suffering through... do I think suffering teaches us? I do think that if you use it as a teaching experience, you learn a lot about everybody involved in your situation. We never really suffer alone, I don't think. I think that if we're suffering, usually something else is suffering. Relationship, you know, a physical being, an emotional sense, and a physical sense, and something is breaking down in your life. Most people aren't just, you know, sitting and suffering because they did something upon themselves, something usually brought on through an outside experience. And in my recent experience, if it's another human being, it's interesting to see how that suffering affects your relationship with that person.
Are you speaking of a particular experience?
For me, well, my brother has been ill. A brother who I had no relationship with. I had a relationship with as a child. You know, you live in the same house, you grow up together, and then we grew apart in our physical lives and our everything. We just, you know, we had nothing in common, so we didn't speak for many, many, many years. And now he's ill, and so the relationship has taken a new turn because I've chosen to take part in his illness to show concern and compassion for a situation, not to hold on to the years in between and all of the stories of, you know, this is how you weren't there for me. You know, it's easy to go there.
Yeah.
And maybe a few years ago I would have gone there. And I honestly, you know, I think that because we are human, we bounce into that first, like, I don't want to deal with, why should I deal with you? You know, not to their face, maybe in our own mind. Why should I deal with him? He was blah, 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 not there for me, abandoned the family, you know, all those things, which he did. That's a fact. And then you're faced with a choice. You can not speak to that person and allow all of those actions that they chose to take at that time affect what you will do now in this situation. And I chose to re-know him, for lack of a better word. I reintroduced myself to him and he to me.
Wow, you know, that's so weird. We're kind of always aligned, but when I was thinking about talking to you today and doing this podcast, we had no topic for the first time, which is so liberating. Because yeah. This is just raw, whatever.
Well, we chatted for 2 hours before. We could probably just always chat and record our conversation and something that we could probably speak to people about because we're always talking about interesting, relevant topics.
Well, we hope, right? That's us in our narcissism thinking we're talking about interesting, relevant.
Everybody wants to hear us and everybody thinks we're interesting.
Yeah. As everybody tunes out now and says, I don't like that podcast. But I was thinking about, it's so funny, building new relationships. So instead of looking at the mind as shut it off, or looking at the ice cream as go away, or looking at, I wish I never went to college or studied that, you know, practicing non-attachment is my attachment to there being a right or wrong way. As well, that there's just a way, and it's neither right nor wrong. It's only the mind that makes that so. And that practice, if I had to try to sum it up, is forming new relationships to the mind, to deep-seated beliefs. And you're physically doing that. So here you are introducing yourself for the first time to somebody you've known for 45 years. And there's nothing really more beautiful than that, because when somebody's that ill, we feel so helpless. Like, what can I do? What can I do? And we just feel like being there is the only thing we can do. Be there and support. But, you know, sometimes that really depends on who in you is there. If the you that's there, not you, I'm just speaking abstractly, but if the you that's there is the old you, with judgments and your roles of who you think you are and who you think he is and what you think about death or what you think about dying or what your opinions are on cancer or heart attacks or whatever, then you're walking in. How in the world would we ever be able to have any space left in us to be a support for somebody with all of that? So what you're doing, I think, is a great lesson for us all, in that you're going there as empty as you can be, as empty of what? As empty of your cara too, the things you think and feel, the personality, and you're trying to walk in there with your practice in cara one, your heart, your true self, your Buddha nature, God, whatever makes you feel comfortable. So you walk in there with as much of Kara 1 that your practice has exposed, that your 2 has allowed, however you want to look at it, and none of that really matters, but, and you're cultivating a new relationship to him. Now, my question to you is, are you cultivating a relationship to his beingness, or are you cultivating a relationship to him as a sick person.
That's a good question. I think I'm cultivating a relationship to him as a just a human being, just a soul in a man's body.
Mm. Right.
Triggered by the fact that he's a sick person, because that's the interesting part, is that had he not become a sick person, he probably would still be that estranged brother that I have.
Interesting. Paint us a picture, though, of what would it look like if you were in there to cultivate a relationship to the sick person. What would that look like?
I still think then you'd be holding on to something, because you're going in there then, you know, feeling sorry for somebody who maybe is suffering. Then my reasoning, I have like an agenda then. Because then he has another label. He's a sick person, you know. Tried to just strip that all away, because I'm honestly trying to build this new relationship with him because I want to. And not for me, not because he's sick. Unfortunately, it for him, that's what brought him to this point in his life. But I would have been happy to have a relationship with him 20 years ago had he been in that place and willing, but he wasn't, and that's the way his life took it. You know, I'm sure there were plenty of times where I was angry about it and went through the full gamut of, you know, anger, resentment, and, you know, all of that. Almost at one point didn't even feel like I had a brother.
I know what that feels like.
Yeah, I know. And you know what? You tried to have a relationship. You know, it's interesting because it's two different human beings. So you don't always come together to the same place and time. And I feel like now that I've gone where I am sitting right now, that it really takes a tragedy. Because if a tragedy doesn't bring one person down to their core of stripping everything away to where they're totally vulnerable and can see, you know, well, learn from your mistakes, you know, see the people and the love that you may have just left behind or taken other paths in your life. Maybe people have been hurt in the wake. Maybe you don't know that. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, judging anybody for it. I'm saying that some of us that are victim to that by default don't have a way to turn it around. It's not in our power, because this is our path that we've been given, and they're on theirs. And when something happens tragic on one side or the other, then there's a choice. If the relationship can turn around, maybe it's the highest resistor that gets some clarity on the path they've chosen and reaches out to the ones they've left behind for forgiveness. And some of them are willing to rebuild a relationship, and some aren't.
Right.
I have both of those in my experience right now, because my brother's son, he's not accepting that.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And he says, the man is the man, and he's the same man. He was a horrible father, and he abandoned me, and he was never there for me. And now, because he's sick, should I look at him as a different man? To me, he's the same man. He's just now the same man who's sick.
And he's looking at him as only that man.
That's it.
Right.
And my brother's asking me every day now via text to talk to him. And, you know, I don't want to put you in the middle, but can you please, you know, I reach out, I call him, he doesn't call me back. I text him, I Facebook him, and there's no response. And really, you know what, he wants to know the reason. And for the last three times he asked me, I want them to tell him the reason, because you were a terrible father. I mean, that is the reason. You're asking me, how do you ask me a reason? Why doesn't my son talk to me? Because you were a bad father to him. That's just the real answer. But obviously, if he's not hearing that himself, which is the truth that he knows about himself, and he's in a vulnerable place in his physical health right now. Yesterday, I answered him for the first time, and I said, don't give up on telling him and showing him that you love him. He's just not in a place where he's ready to hear that right now.
Yeah, that's all you can do, right?
I can't speak for other people. No. You know, I've hard enough time speaking for myself.
Right.
So it's just interesting that, you know, it reaches a lot of situations, reach a lot of people, because we're all involved and connected somehow in our family groups, our friend groups, and not everybody will make the same choice given the same or similar, you know, situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the bad news is that, yeah, it does take death or birth to get people to find forgiveness or not even forgive, just be there because they think being there is somehow maybe a way of being in the process of forgiving. I also think that the good news is that is a landscape, not to use that word again, but it's a landscape for practice.
Absolutely.
Because as you practice, you see that, yes, there are people that you don't like and don't want to be around for one reason or another. And just because they're family doesn't mean that you have all this obligation. I don't believe that. I did, oh my word, for a majority of my life I did. However, I feel like everything really can only happen from inside us. I can't change anything except my perception and myself. And I don't even look at it as change anymore. I look at it as a shedding into what is actually real and present in all of us. Nobody has any other specialness that one person can be in a practice and another person can't be, or one person's enlightened and another person's not. I think we all carry this, and it's very cathartic to look at each person in our life, whether they're family or friends, and to hold that mirror up to see what you could learn about yourself through the difficulties of any relationship. Scary, yeah. I mean, it's scary to see that reflection. You look back and there's this monster in the mirror, because that's who maybe we become when we're with that person. Or that's what that person represents to us, and we're not yet able to see that that is our own reflection. So we can run, and we can hide, and we can move from these people that we think we don't like. But in your example of creating new relationships, everybody in families has that choice to create a new relationship. You don't have to show up at Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas dinner or Hanukkah Seder. And is that the correct term? A Hanukkah Seder?
Passover Seder.
Oh, sorry. What would you call Hanukkah? Just, is there a dinner?
It's a celebration. It's a
festivities.
It's a festival of light.
Oh, yes, right. So you could show up there and walk in metaphorically empty or attempting to be empty. And listen, you know, everybody has varying degrees of trauma. If it's trauma you don't think you can face, like physical abuse as a child or sexual abuse as a child, if it's not a suffering that you feel ready for, there's a lot of wisdom in that too. There's a lot of wisdom in being able to say, you know what, I'm not there yet. But having that conversation with yourself is much more important than having that conversation with somebody else. And, you know, over the holidays, which are fast approaching, we get with family, and as Ram Dass has always said, you think you're enlightened, you think you're changed, in quotes, and you have balance, go visit your family for a week.
Somehow it's the best place to practice.
It is the best place to practice because we're walking right back into who they think we are. And in defense of that, the only experience that I have had is that when I think that I have changed, I haven't. When I walk around saying, I'm so different now, I pretty much find that I'm not different at all.
Well, don't you also think that when it comes to our family relationships, I think maybe I haven't taught my children this exactly, but in general, you're told to love your family, and we don't choose them. They're here, and we're part of this family. And so as you grow up and start to form your own opinion and become your own person and maybe start practicing some spirituality or religion, you make decisions on if you really like somebody or not. And would I choose this person to be in my satsang they weren't born into my bloodline?
Right.
And a lot of times the answer is no.
And then we feel guilty about it. So to me, it's just like school. Don't ask questions.
Exactly. So why is it not okay to not like somebody? Just don't like them.
I agree, as long as the self-work is being done, because sometimes our minds convince us that we don't like somebody because we don't like the parts of us that they bring out. But anytime I've been faced with that, I have seen that it's not that person that it ends with. So I don't just not see that person and that part of me disappears. That part of me is in me. It's just laying dormant. And you see your family, and that is just a surefire trigger to allow that person to come out. But there's also that trigger is living in you. And so it doesn't come out as easy maybe when you're with a gas station attendant or a supermarket checkout clerk or a girlfriend or a boyfriend, but eventually that trigger will come again. So the easiest and the hardest practice of yoga is with your family. It depends on who in you is going back home for Christmas or having these people at your house for the holidays.
Right.
If I walk in as Katrina 2, they're going to assault every part of me. And it's going to be horrible for me because I think I am Katrina 2. If I can find a balance and maybe go into the bathroom as many times as I need to, or have a writing on my hand. I'm all about the reminders because I don't even think I could do this without the reminders. Those reminders, that something that brings you back home, and I mean that metaphorically in the heart sense, what brings you back home? And they say something, and if you are practicing, whatever they're saying is showing you where you're stuck. In Buddhism, they call it shenpa. Where you're clinging, where you can direct your practice. Maybe you wait till you get home. Maybe you go into the bathroom and you do it right there and then. But something, because they're not magical, these people. They're not magically going, I am going to cause suffering. And, you know, they're hitting this certain button. They're hitting that certain button because that's all they've known. And really, at some point, you just have to say that's their business. That's their thing. That's what they do. But the only thing I can change and I can practice with is my reaction. Yeah. What is my reaction to them? But more importantly, what is my reaction in myself? The first thing I do is I try to just find some quiet. Now, that might not be possible in a house full of people, but you could also be quiet within. And I ask myself where I feel this, because usually with that trigger, the family, I feel a constriction inside my body. It might just be in my shoulders. It might be in my eyes. I might feel like I'm getting a headache. I might feel really tired. My hands might start to hurt. It's different for everybody, and it's different every time. Where do I feel that in my body? And I allow my body to participate in that moment, because if it's my hands, I slowly start massaging my hands. Not like shaking them and holy shit, my hands are killing me and making it about my hands. Just my hands are being invited in. And maybe it's my posture. Maybe my shoulders are slumped and I'm closing my heart down because I feel like I need to protect it. Well, I mean, basically, these are what are contained in practices. But carry that Rumi quote with you through your holidays. The try not to resist the changes that come your way. Instead, let life live through you. And do not worry that your life is turning upside down. I'll add, because it's temporary. How do you know that the side you are used to is better than the one to come? So if you're practicing and you're going home to your family, they become the teachers for you in that moment because they're showing you where you could direct your practice because guess what? They got you. They tell you this, they tell you that, blah, 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 and it triggers you. And what are your alternatives? To lash out at them, make this trip horrific, make it uncomfortable, everybody gets quiet, everybody's stuck in their roles and their models. I'm the father, I'm the mother, I'm the sister, I'm the brother. What you're doing, Kara, is inspiring me to do that this holiday. To, whether I can empty out or not, to just have an awareness of that word empty. Because that's it's a spirit of empty, right? It doesn't have to be, that's an intention, but it's a different way of putting it. The spirit of being empty. If I have the spirit of being empty and I walk in and family or friends that are your family, they trigger something, I'm going to see how I would take that if it were not loaded with a load of history. We do have a choice. I like to think that we can, instead of throwing out our family because we don't, like, quote unquote, like them, we can enter into our family to cultivate a new relationship that could benefit our practice. It's very easy to write people off. Very easy.
I agree. Just, you know, in doing that for you and anybody else who might try that, remember that it's a two-part happening. For yourself, that's a great practice. For for yourself to try and walk in somewhere empty and lose the stories and walk in without any history in your mind of what that person represents and brings to you. But if they're not there and they're not doing that with you, and they haven't made that conscious decision before they see you, and they are who they are and who they've always been, they're not participating in that. So that the same person for them is showing up, is what I'm saying. In my situation, we've both become different people in this situation, in this illness, in this unfortunate relationship flip.
Yeah.
He's not who he was. I'm not who I was. So it truly is a different place. Mm-hmm. So I think it's great to do that practice with everybody. And I think that if you can replace some of those old stories and feelings and anger and all the things we carry around about people before you see them and replace it with some compassion. I've tried that myself, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes I get back to that place in 2 seconds, and sometimes it takes 2 hours, which those 2 hours is a gift I gave myself. But, you know, just keeping knowing that if the other person is not a participant in that exercise, that they are who they are because that's who they are.
Well, so, I would assume that they weren't any different.
I know.
I would assume that, because the practice is to not walk in with all of these attachments, and you could assume that the rest of the world, really, it's none of our business whether they're practicing or not. If they are, we might not even know it, and we can't align our practice around who's practicing or not. I mean, practice could be through religion, too. It could be through meditation with no lineage at all. But it's totally and completely about you. Whatever you meet in there is material for practice. And the other alternative is that you will just stand with the suffering, and eventually, maybe later, a week, maybe a day, maybe years, you can utilize that day, this day, these days of the holidays, as a way to see how much we walk in with an agenda that this person's going to be this way, that person's going to be that way, and then I know what I'm going to feel because I felt it last year. I felt it when I saw them 2 months ago.
Dropping that is a gift that you can give yourself. And I only interjected that because some, you know, not everybody listening, it you know, gets that part of it. And I know for myself that probably if you would have said that to me as an exercise, you know, 3 years ago, maybe even 2 years ago, I might have gone in, got my whole self, like, you know, ready and
centered and ready.
Yeah, and then walked in and been like, they're the same damn person they were last time. You know,
so, and they should be. Why shouldn't they be?
Because it's never about anybody else. But just the beginning part of the don't know mind is really just knowing that you don't know, and it's always only about you. And if you have to, I know I have to remind myself of that all the time, and that is just, so what? It's not about them. I can't tell you how many times I say that in a day to friends, family, kids, you know, even my own mother.
Yes, of course.
My brother's concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. I think if you go in, if you had to have any intention, the intention could just be to notice. You're not there to judge, although you will, and then your agenda is how kind you could be to yourself through the judgments if you're somebody that goes, I should be practicing, I should be spiritual, I should be a yogi. Like, honestly, throw out every single one of those, because you don't be spiritual. You don't be a yogi. You have to practice from where we're at. Otherwise, you're trying to go for perfection, and that's just not really a place to want to end up. You know, we want to utilize the life that we have. And if the life that you have is that you're about to walk into 16 people that are the biggest pains of the asses, that there's no depth of conversation, that the man is always sitting on the couch watching football, or the woman is always sitting on the couch watching football, or whatever it is, you walk in and your work is at that moment is not to walk in with just that mind net, that two, but to also do whatever you need to do that gets you in touch with that one. They talk about the fact that emotional states are not something that happen to us, rather we create them based on how we view the world. So your emotional states are based on whatever judgment or preconceived, and it could be fact. But you're creating that world. I'm creating that world before I walk in the room, and all I'm saying is just notice the world you're creating before you walk in the room. If it's none, then great. Let the now inform you rather than the memories and the past. And it's not for them, although it would benefit them, it's for you. Because you've lived how long already with family and friends that have triggered you, and what has the outcome been so far? Most likely, if you're listening to this and this is resonating at all, the results haven't been that great. I know my own weren't that great either, and continue to sometimes not be that great. But then I have to work on not going down the rabbit hole of how I should have been different or when this happened, blah, 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 blah. So what I say is that this holiday is about cultivating the witness. What's the witness? Well, there's a difference between the observer from that which is being observed. So think of the observer as the witness. Imagine you're watching a show, that you at that moment watching that show is the observer. And imagine that the ego mind, which comes with our memories, our judgments, all the predetermined, they're going to be this, they're going to be this, I'm going to be this. I mean, we have our own predetermined rituals that we get into of the mind. That is the object being observed. So it's basically our incarnation. So in cultivating the witness has no opinion. The witness is never going to say, ooh, look at how they're still eating, or wow, they gained a lot of weight, or I wonder if they think I'm fat. Do I look skinnier? Do I look older? Can they tell? And we check ourselves in the mirror, whatever it is that is your bag. I'm just asking for there to be a noticing, only because that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be noticing if I show up as the observer of my Katrina-ness with family, or am I going to be stuck in the ego mind, in my incarnation, in my personality, not allowing the witness, the observer, to see the mind as the observed? Because you'll feel a separation in that. You'll feel like you're witnessing what your mind is thinking and doing. And with that comes almost like, aww, look what Katrina's thinking, or look what Katrina's feeling about that person. And but it doesn't have even that kind of a feeling to it, because the witness is just stating facts. So like the witness might say, ah, there's judging. Ah, there's perfection, meaning that I'm trying to be spiritual. So in my ego mind, spirituality makes somebody perfect. So you can label it. You can label it as a way to get a better understanding, working towards understanding what the Buddha said, that clinging is what causes us the suffering, clinging to ideas and concepts and who we think we are. which then feeds to who we think everybody else is. I'm really honored that you talked about your brother, Kara. And I know that from being your friend, you are cultivating the witness when you're in there with him. And through your practice, you're able to walk in there. Yes, it is an even playing field because he is a different person because of his suffering through this illness, with this illness. And your practice started long before he got sick. The reason why, and I think you'll agree, tell me if you don't at all and I'll shut up, but the reason why you're able to walk in there noticing empty, that you're trying it, not trying, you're just being with the emptiness, and that your cultivation of the observer and the difference between the observed, the mind being observed, is because you've had a practice for years.
Yeah, absolutely. Most definitely.
Imagine if you would have waited till this kind of suffering to first enter into it, which is very common. People come to yoga and practices only when this moment happens.
Yeah, of course, because something life-changing happens. I think something life-changing happens to everybody to enter into some type of belief system. So whether it's a, hopefully it's not something this tragic, it could be a failed relationship or something in your life happens and you seek the satsang, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You seek the people that you can speak to. You need, you know, for me, I wouldn't make it through most of my life if I couldn't pick up the phone and call you and just talk about anything, just be me and show up how I am in whatever I'm going through, and know that we could talk about it and there's no judgment and you can look at different angles and ask me questions, because we say things about each other sometimes that we don't see in ourselves, and, you know, call you out on something, or maybe you're in your judging mind. I'm in mine all the time.
Right.
I can catch myself now, though, in certain things, and in certain things I can't. So we do need a group. I think that it's hard to go it alone. And I think if I came into this situation before I started any kind of practice, I might have been in the same place that my brother's son is in, which is resistant to this person who's showing up sick and wants to know me, because I know that, you know, your mind just jumps in and tells you all the horror stories that have happened and bring in all the reasons why you shouldn't accept and know this person. And then, you know, then you're fighting that, and you're either going to give in to that or you're going to get snapped into some type of seeking really quickly. And you know what? If anyone out there is listening, I hope you don't find it too late, because you'll hear those stories too, where it took the tragic loss of somebody to even begin, and then you're just picking up fragmented pieces. So, no, I'm grateful that I had the strength to come to the decision to just take a breath and step back and listen, you know.
That's powerful. That's really powerful.
And I hope that anybody listening has a great holiday with their families, however that translates. And if you do one good thing for yourself, just challenge yourself to look at somebody in a way you never looked at them before. Just one person, somebody who maybe rubs you the wrong way or brings out that bitch in you, or, you know, just try and look at them a way you never looked at them before. And then I think it'll be interesting to everybody does that, and then we check back
after that
and come up with some results.
Yeah, I would love that. I would love that. You can email that to zitlcourse@gmail.com, or you can post it on the Facebook, just Facebook/functional yoga. And I'll put that quote up for you.
I'll put them both up. Put the Socrates quote up too.
Oh, okay. Sure. And I'll even put the verbiage that I was taught about cultivating the witness and seeing the difference between observer and that which is being observed. Because I think that's really confusing, and I hate to confuse cultivating the witness because it doesn't need any more confusion than it already is. It's a noticing. So I think what you're saying is we can both be taking action, and we can also be noticing the action we're taking. And through right. the noticer, the witness, that's when we can start to seek new relationship by seeing what's really serving us and others and what's not. And it's okay to not be in the place yet to be able to handle family or certain topics like politics or anything like that. I mean, there's so much power when you speak to somebody who's in practice that says, I'm going to stop talking now because I'm not in the place where I can come from an educated, moved to wisdom place. I've read all this in a book and I feel like my mind is going with that side, but I've not yet experienced it. Wow. What freedom there is in that. To let go of that part of us that thinks that we're supposed to know everything. Yeah, Nietzsche says, whatever is done for love always occurs beyond good and evil. Really think about that. Good and evil, maybe right and wrong. Maybe black and white. But when love is the seed that is planted, it's beyond that. And when we all are serving love, that love in ourselves and that love for others, which is what happens when somebody gets sick that you weren't speaking to, the only thing standing in that moment is that love. And all the other bullshit goes away. So why wait? If you're interested in topics like this, and you want to start your own personal practice, there's a course called Zooming in the Lens that I teach and guide with my teacher, Ram Dass. He's not in it, but he is sponsoring it and supporting it. And we're in the middle of group three right now, and I'm looking for groups of the age of 17 to 24 or 25. I'd like to put together a small group of that age group, but we're also working on many other age groups and many other topics. So if you're interested in that, go to functionalyogaonline.com or Ramdass, that's two S's, .org/zooming. Thank you, everybody. I wish you the greatest holiday. There's so much to be grateful for. And I'm definitely grateful for the experience of practicing live on Zooming in the Lens podcast and for my friendship with the people and the friends I've brought on this, and to you, Kara. I love you dearly.
I love you too. I'm grateful for you. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, everybody. Bye-bye.
Another very important topic when we meditate is how to handle discomfort. As I mentioned before, discomfort is part of life. It's part of the human condition. Discomfort could be physical. We're a little too hot. We're a little too cold. It could be we're tired. It could be we're too jazzed up because we had too much coffee or tea. It could be fear of the next meeting or the next class. It could be unfulfilled expectations. It could be wanting something to happen that isn't. There's all kinds of discomfort that runs through the human condition. We spend much of our time trying to get rid of discomfort in this culture. Either get rid of it or possibly deny it, or possibly distract ourselves from it. But discomfort is the first thing you notice when you slow down, cease your busyness, and just look at how you're feeling. It could be very subtle. In the practice of meditation, we become aware of how discomfort really is part of every moment of life. Even if we feel very good, there's a slight discomfort that is going to slip away. We know that even the most pure happiness is not permanent. In the practice of meditation, and this is a very, very important point, discomfort needs to be explored. Discomfort is not what it looks like on the surface. Discomfort is a sign of life. It's a sign of intelligence. It's an uprising of energy. It's a presence of vitality in our being. What we call discomfort is just energy that is a little bit too intense, intelligence that's a little bit too intense. And you find this out when you practice meditation, because what you realize is that the ego is what finds things uncomfortable. And when you practice meditation, your level of what you consider discomfort changes, and sometimes discomfort actually changes into something entirely different. Discomfort is not a static thing. It's not a solid entity. It's an interpretation. And we need to explore that interpretation. Once again, what the ego labels as discomfort is a perception that's a little too vivid, a feeling that's a little too strong, an uprising of energy that's a little too intense. Discomfort is ego's label that it puts on anything that it feels it can't control. In the Tibetan tradition, it's said that when you explore the various territories of discomfort in your life, you find that behind them is a powerful voice of wisdom. This is possibly a confusing teaching, to say that discomfort, pain, suffering are not what they seem to be. But we need to hear this at the beginning of the meditative path to understand why it is said that the purpose of meditation is to engage our experience. And particularly if our experience is uncomfortable, we might not want to do that. And the tradition is basically saying, yes, engage your discomfort, engage your suffering. When you feel it, look at it, meditate on it, open yourself to it, and see where it leads. When energy or perceptions or feelings are intense, there's always a pathway there for us. The goal of meditation is to work with that pathway, to walk along that pathway and see where it takes us.
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.